That was Sarah Brightman singing Music of the Night. You are tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, and this is Monday at 6 p.m., and it's time for another episode of Health and the Awakening of the Self. That self is spelled with a capital S. And in this program, we give out information to help you to preserve and restore your health. And also, we give out information and techniques to awaken the full potential, the full self, who you really meant to be, your full potential. And we do these by exercises of self-inquiry, and that's called the teachings of non-duality. In the East, they're called the teachings of Vedanta, and they go back way back to Shankaracharya over 1,000 years ago. My name is Dr. Mike. I'm an MD and a naturopath and a teacher of meditation for a good number of years. You can call into this program at any time during the proceedings. We won't take exception. You can interrupt the show for any kind of questions or comments you want to make. The number to call is 831-427-3772. And the email here, which I don't use that much, but I have to learn how to use it here in the studio. It's frsc@freakradio.org. Freak Radio is all one word. If you have a spiritual teacher that's teaching some aspect of the truth and you'd like to have him on this program, please contact me. We'll see about putting him on. As usual, the slogan of this program is, may your heart be absorbed, may your mind be absorbed in your heart, or may your mind fall into this, to the state of beingness or the state of presence, that deeper aspect of ourself, the heart. The self and truth are to be found not so much in books or in television or radio programs, but the truth and the self is to be found within your own experience. That's why we put emphasis on exercises, the experiential exercises that we give out here, and also on the guided meditation part of it. I hope you like the music. The music is Sarah Brightman, and I've seen her in live concerts. She's one of my favorite singers. Now we're going to go on to an interesting topic here, or at least I find it interesting. It's about something that I queued it up for this. I just want to make sure it's holding. It is holding. So what this is about is often the Christian people, they quote to you from the Bible a statement that says, I am the way, the truth, and the light, etc., and only through me can you come to the truth. I've seen that very statement made almost the same words by some teachers from the East, and so it's interesting that two people, Jesus of Nazareth and this other teacher, I forgot who it was, saying the same things. Here's an explanation, actually, of what that really means. It's not like, we're not talking about the ego personality when that statement is made. It's basically referring to a deeper identification with spirit, with the I am-ness. Master Muji will explain that right now to you.
Next one, who's coming?
Ah, very good.
In St. John's Gospel, in the Holy Bible,
yes,
Jesus says, no one comes to the Father except by me.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
And these words, I think there's been a lot of misunderstanding about them.
Yes.
Which has caused a lot of division rejection, and even for some people, you know, they would abandon the teachings of Jesus because of this statement.
But they would have to say why they would have abandoned.
Yes, I'd be grateful if you could share your understanding of what Jesus said.
I totally hear what you're saying, and myself had contemplated it. No, we have to say according to the Gospels as we know them. This is what he said, that no one comes to the Father except through me. You see, sounds like four. That's a very tight place. It means that if you think beyond, that's the sense that people would take, or the first reaction would be like, whoa, you have to go through Jesus, or else basically there's no way to the Father, you see, like that. And I feel that the predominantly the Christian culture has used that statement, like this is our, you know, that builds a lot upon this statement, that, you know, this is sufficient to prove that Jesus is the only way to God. This is something like this, not like that. And but earlier, if I can take an example earlier, no? I remember another place where Jesus was speaking to some of the Pharisees and the Sadducees and from the Sanhedrin of his time, which was like the political authority, the Orthodox faiths and so on of the time, no? And they were sort of, there was some friction, some tension felt by the established religious body, that here comes this young man who with such seemingly radical ideas, sort of working miracles, attracting a lot of people, and they were a little sort of like a bit uncomfortable with this message, because he was very unafraid and confronted many things that no one had talked about until then. So in one encounter, he had been talking with some of these people, and he had said, if you knew the truth would set you free. And they retorted and said, you know, ho, 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 you know, we are children of Abraham. You see? Who do you think you're talking about? We are children of Abraham. And I say, as though being children of Abraham entitled them to automatic freedom or like this, you see? And then he said, in response to their what they spoke, you know, he said, if you were true children of Abraham, you would have listened to me and accepted what I say to you, because Abraham spoke of me. And this really aroused a lot of reaction from them. They said, what are you saying, you know? Do you know what you're saying? Our father Abraham lived centuries and centuries ago. You're a young man, maybe 33 years old or whatever. How dare you speak like that? Are you saying you are as great as our father Abraham? And he hit straight back, you see, with this statement. He said, to tell you the truth, before Abraham was born, I am. You see? Okay. Now, I have to say this because it's linked to your question. He said, before Abraham was born or even conceived, I am. So obviously, he couldn't mean the body that we know as Jesus, because that was only 33 years old or something. No? What is this I am that he's referring to? You see? Because it is said that also this I am is said to be also the name of God, I am. And he's saying, before Abraham was born, I am. Let's rewind way, way back to the time when the children of Israel were being set free from the hold in Egypt. And then Moses was commanded by God, it said like this. It's all linked, so please stay with me a minute. And then Moses was told by God, go and confront the Pharaoh and tell him to set the Israelites free. And Moses was very, very afraid. He says, what are you saying? I am not on good terms with them at this moment. And, you know, I cannot go in my name. Who should I say sent me? And God said, say, I am sent you. And so much power came into Moses that he could move forward and confront the fear like this. So now it brings it back again now. Jesus' statement. He said, no one comes to the Father except me. I say, what is meant, no one comes to the Father except through the I Am. And I want to say what I mean by this I Am, because all sentient beings, certainly all human beings, refer to themselves as through the sense I Am. Nobody taught us to say I Am. Your parents did not call you I. They called you a name like John or Susan or something like that, depending upon our culture. And yet all of us instinctively, intuitively, spontaneously refer to ourselves as this I Am. And so this sense, really, I Am, is what Jesus meant. Not just the person of Jesus, but the I Am itself. He understood the power of it. Most people don't understand the power or the implication of what it means to say I Am. No one comes to the Father except through understanding and being one with God through the I Am sense in them. They must know that the I Am is not a person, but it is the presence of God or the Holy Presence. This is what it means by that. And if people understood this, I don't know if they would have even agreed at that time or accepted what he spoke or understood what he said. I feel it was still, it might have been seen to be provocative, but I think it's also, I feel also that it was very dynamic, very, very authoritative, very powerful, very unafraid, and very true also. Because in his understanding, the I Am and himself are not different. So he had the right to speak like this. And now, in our own time, myself, I'm also pointing to this I Am, that it must be understood, because everyone say I Am, but don't really understand. We all take I Am to be a person, a personality, or an ego. But it is much more than this.
And in your experience, what is it? Could you share with us what it is? In your experience,
I Am is consciousness. You can say I Am is consciousness. It is not a person. I Am is consciousness. You see? And then it is not enough to say it is consciousness. People say, okay, because we're used to feeling that we learn by simply having an intellectual understanding of something. But then sadhana, or the environment of satsang, helps us to come to a living and direct understanding and experience of that I Amness itself, and to rescue it from this universal delusion, actually, that I Am is merely a person. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, so that was an interesting understanding of that statement that basically you have to come through me to reach God, more or less. All right, now we're going to give a little airing to Amazing Grace and its song again by Sarah Brightman.
when you're making baked goods like cakes, muffins, and bread.
Okay, that was Sarah Brightman singing Amazing Grace. I'm sorry, I had the lever pushed a bit far up there. It was starting to crackle. Sorry about that. All right, the next... Okay, the next talk is by a medical doctor, and he's written some books on reincarnation, and I thought his talk was kind of interesting. We're not going to play it all tonight. We'll have to divide it into two or three sections.
His research is focused on near-death experiences. His work has resulted in more than 80 presentations and 100 publications in academic and medical journals. He is the Chester Carlson Professor of Psychiatry and Neurobehavioral Studies and the Director of the Division of Perceptual Studies at the University of Virginia. And he's also a Distinguished Life Fellow of the American Psychiatric Association. So please, everybody, welcome Dr. Bruce Grayson.
Yesterday morning, His Holiness joked that his brain was too cold to try to speak in English. I feel the same way today. Yes. I want to start by thanking Geshe Lakdor and Bryce Johnson for organizing this conference and keeping everything running so smoothly. I also want to thank Karma and Paldin and all the many other people who have been working behind the scenes to take care of us, providing us with everything from excellent translations to warm tea. Yesterday, we focused on some very, very big questions. Is there consciousness in other galaxies? What was the origin of consciousness? What is it like to be a bat or an octopus or a tree? This morning, I want to shift the focus to an easier question. What is it like to be a human being? Most Western scientists assume that consciousness is produced in some way by the brain. There is, of course, a lot of evidence for that position. There is common sense evidence from our everyday lives. When you drink too much alcohol, or when you get knocked hard on your head, you don't think very clearly. We also have more sophisticated evidence from science of the link between the brain and consciousness. We can measure electrical activity in the brain during certain kinds of mental tasks and identify correlations between different areas of the brain and different activities. We can stimulate parts of the brain and record what experiences result. And we can remove parts of the brain and observe the effects on behavior. All of this evidence suggests that the brain is indeed involved in thinking, perception, and memory. But it does not necessarily suggest that the brain causes those thoughts, perceptions, and memories. As you are listening to me speak, there is electrical activity in the temporal lobe of your brain in an area called Brodmann's area. But does that electrical activity in your brain suggest that your temporal lobe is producing the sound of my voice? Not at all. All of the studies showing brain areas associated with different mental functions show only correlations, not causation. They are entirely consistent with the idea that thoughts, perceptions, and memories could take place in a consciousness somewhere separate from the brain, but are then received and processed by specific areas in the brain. It's much like a telephone or a radio or a television. The signal, the message, is created somewhere else, but your cell phone is necessary to receive and process the message. If we were to measure the electrical activity inside your cell phone, or electrically excite certain parts of it, or remove certain vital parts of your cell phone, we could show that certain parts of the phone were involved in your hearing the phone message. But we would not be proving that the message originated within your cell phone, any more than we can prove that our thoughts originate within our brains. Western science is largely reductionistic. That is, it breaks everything down to its component parts, which are much easier to study than the whole. But as Chris Impey said yesterday, the component parts sometimes do not act like the whole. The brain is composed of millions of nerve cells or neurons. But a single neuron, as Chris told us, cannot formulate a thought. A single neuron cannot feel angry or cold. It seems that brains, we think, can think and feel, but brain cells can't. We don't know how many neurons you need in order for them to collectively formulate a thought. And we don't know how that collection of neurons can think when a single neuron can't. As Chris said yesterday, scientists get around this problem by saying that consciousness is an emergent property of brains, a property that emerges when a large enough mass of brain cells get together. What does that mean? We have no idea what that means. Saying that something is an emergent property is a way of saying that it is a mystery that we can't explain. There is, in fact, no known mechanism by which physical processes in the brain or anywhere else can produce non-physical things like thoughts, perceptions, and memories. The materialistic understanding of the world fails to deal with just how an electrical impulse or a chemical trigger in the brain can produce a thought or a feeling, or indeed anything that the mind does. And yet, despite having no idea how it could work, most neuroscientists continue to maintain this 19th century materialistic view that the brain, in some miraculous way we don't understand, produces consciousness. And they discount or ignore the evidence that consciousness, in extreme circumstances, can function very well without a brain. Now, this idea that the mind and the brain are separate things was what most people in the world believed until a couple of hundred years ago. But in the 19th century, at least in the West, beginning with the Darwinians and the physiological psychologists, we started exploring the notion that the physical brain might be the source of all our thoughts and emotions, indeed of all of consciousness. For the past century, psychologists have been moving toward the hardcore materialism that characterized 19th century physics, a physics based on classical Newtonian mechanics. They've been attempting to show that consciousness is nothing more than the working of the physical brain. This materialistic psychology was succinctly captured by the American psychologist John Watson, who wrote, quote, "Psychology, as we view it, is a purely objective, experimental branch of science that needs consciousness as little as do the sciences of chemistry and physics." It is ironic that while Watson was linking psychology to classical Newtonian physics, physicists, faced with overwhelming experimental evidence, were already moving away from that materialistic view of the universe to a quantum physics that could not be formulated without reference to consciousness playing an independent role in the universe. As Harold Marowitz, a molecular biophysicist at Yale University, wrote, quote, "It is as if the two disciplines, psychology and physics, were on fast-moving trains going in opposite directions and not noticing what is happening across the tracks." Just as the materialistic idea that the brain produces the mind is a reasonably good model for our everyday lives, so too classical Newtonian physics was a reasonably good model for everyday objects moving at everyday speeds. It was only when physicists started investigating extraordinary circumstances about 100 years ago involving objects approaching the speed of light or the behavior of microscopic wave particles that we saw the limitations of the classical Newtonian model and the need for new paradigms. The result was the development of quantum physics, which explained the world in ways that classical Newtonian physics could not. But the price physicists paid in developing quantum physics was to acknowledge consciousness as a fundamental aspect of existence, independent of matter. So too with the question of the mind-brain relationship. It is only when we look at extraordinary circumstances of mental function, such as what happens when we approach death, that we see the limitations of the materialistic model of mind-brain identity and the need for a different paradigm. Geshe Choden said yesterday that, according to Buddhist teaching, consciousness can sustain itself without a brain, or indeed without any other physical form. 19th century reductionistic science viewed consciousness as an emergent property that evolved with complex brains. But just as quantum physics now views consciousness as an irreducible component in the universe, so too scientific research in the past century has explored human experiences that suggest consciousness can function without a brain. The evidence that I'm going to discuss this morning is derived entirely from scientific research, but I do not want to give you the impression that this evidence is widely accepted by Western scientists. In fact, most Western scientists are completely unaware that this evidence even exists. What then are these data that challenge the materialistic conception that consciousness is produced entirely by the brain? This is the University of Virginia, where I work. For the past half century, the University of Virginia has had a research division dedicated solely to the scientific investigation of these human experiences that challenge the materialistic philosophy that brain and mind are the same, and suggest instead that the mainstream ideas about the relationship between matter and consciousness are incomplete. In the mid-1960s, Chester Carlson, a wealthy American inventor who invented the first photocopy machine, which he called the Xerox machine, started giving away his fortune. He told his wife that his one remaining ambition in life was to die a poor man. His wife introduced him to Buddhism, and he went on to fund several Buddhist centers in New York, including the Rochester Zen Center, led by Philip Kaplow, and the Dai Bosatsu Zendo Kangoji Zen Monastery, led by Edo Tai Shimano. For his good works, Chester Carlson was given the Dharma name Daitokuin Zenshin Carlson Koji. But Carlson was also a scientist trained as a physicist, and he wanted to support a bridge between Buddhism and Western science. He had heard about very young children in India who appeared to remember their past lives, and he searched for a Western neuroscientist who was interested in investigating these children. He found an eager disciple in Ian Stevenson, the chairman of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Virginia. Carlson donated to the university the funds to establish our research division. And with Carlson's financial and moral support, Professor Stevenson resigned as chairman of the department to devote himself full time to the scientific study of these children who seemed to recall past lives and to other human experiences that suggest that consciousness may at times function without the use of a physical brain. As it happened, shortly thereafter, His Holiness the Dalai Lama began periodic visits to the University of Virginia to visit Jeffrey Hopkins, a professor of Tibetan Buddhist studies, who served as His Holiness's chief translator in English until 1989. In this photo, you can see Professor Hopkins, Professor Stevenson, and His Holiness at the University of Virginia in 1979. I had worked with Professor Stevenson since the early 1970s when I was training to be a psychiatrist at the University of Virginia. Under his mentorship, I studied a variety of human experiences that suggested consciousness functioning separate from the brain. But I focused primarily on near-death experiences, the complex experiences that some people have on the threshold of death, when the brain is shutting down. 10 years ago, Professor Stevenson retired, and I succeeded him as director of our research division. So what are these experiences that challenge the prevailing materialistic paradigm that consciousness cannot exist without a functioning brain? There are four lines of evidence that I wish to discuss with you this morning. These are, first, the unexplained recovery of consciousness among people who have been unconscious for prolonged periods of time in the moments or days before their death. Second, the complex consciousness among people who have minimal brain tissue. Third, surprisingly complex consciousness in near-death experiences when the brain is not functioning or functioning at a greatly diminished level. And finally, young children who recall accurate details of a past life. The first challenging phenomenon I want to discuss is the surprising recovery on the deathbed of mental functions that had long been lost. This unexpected return of mental clarity and memory shortly before death in patients suffering from severe neurologic or psychiatric disorders has been reported in the Western medical literature over the past 250 years, but has received little attention. There are cases published in the medical literature of patients suffering from brain abscesses, tumors, strokes, meningitis, Alzheimer's disease and other dementias, schizophrenia, and mood disorders, all of whom had long ago lost the ability to think or communicate. In many of these patients, there was evidence from brain scans or from autopsies that their brains had deteriorated to an irreversible degree. And yet, in all of these cases, mental clarity returned in the last minutes, hours, or sometimes days before the patient's death. We have identified 83 cases mentioned in the Western medical literature and have collected additional unpublished contemporary accounts. Complete recovery of consciousness just before death is not a common experience. In 1844, a German psychiatrist named Julius estimated that it occurred in 13% of patients who had died in his institution. However, in a recent investigation of end-of-life experiences in the United Kingdom, 70% of caregivers in nursing homes reported that they had observed patients with dementia and confusion becoming completely lucid in their last hours before death. In a case that we recently investigated, a 42-year-old man developed a malignant brain tumor that rapidly grew in size. He quickly became bedridden, blind in one eye, and unable to communicate, became completely incoherent and bizarre in his behavior. He appeared to be unable to make any sense of his surroundings, and when his family touched him, he would slap as if he were slapping at an insect. He eventually stopped sleeping and would talk deliriously throughout the night, making no sense. After several weeks of that, he suddenly, one night, appeared calm and started speaking coherently and then slept peacefully. The following morning, he remained completely clear and talked with his wife, discussing his imminent death for the first time. However, he stopped speaking in a few minutes and died soon thereafter. A second case involving Alzheimer's disease was reported by Erlendur Haraldsson, a psychologist in Iceland. An 81-year-old woman had been demented for a long time and was living in a nursing home. Her family took turns visiting her, even though she didn't recognize them and hadn't spoken to them for a year. On one occasion, her son Leiter was sitting at her bedside, working on a crossword puzzle. Suddenly, she looked up at him. She looked him directly in the face and said, "My son Leiter, I'm going to recite a verse for you." She then recited a poem clearly and loudly. She then lay back on her pillow and remained quiet until she died. There is no known physiological mechanism for this phenomenon. It is indeed rare, but the fact that it happens at all has no explanation in terms of how the brain functions. It suggests that the link between consciousness and the brain is more complex than we usually think. It is as if the damaged brain prevents the person from thinking or communicating. But then, as the brain finally begins to die, consciousness is released from the grasp of the degenerating brain. Another challenging phenomenon is the presence of normal or even high intelligence in people who have very little brain tissue. There are, again, rare but surprising cases of people who seem to function normally in life, with normal intelligence and normal social function, despite having virtually no brain at all. In one case published in 2007, a high school honor student who had been accepted into Smith College underwent surgery after she was injured and knocked unconscious in an automobile accident. An X-ray of her head just before surgery revealed that she had no cerebral cortex at all. She had just a brainstem inside her skull. And when the surgeon opened up her skull to operate, that is exactly what he found. Just a brainstem with no cerebral cortex. Now, our best understanding of the normal brain is that the brainstem relays motor and sensory signals to the cerebellum and the spinal cord and integrates heart function, breathing, level of wakefulness, and other animal functions. But the brainstem does not have the connections to perform higher cognitive functions like thinking, perceiving, making decisions, and so on. That can only happen in the cerebral cortex, which this young girl did not have. So this young college-bound honor student, according to our best understanding of the brain, should have been completely unable to formulate any thought of any kind, let alone function at a high intellectual level. John Lorber, a British neurologist, specialized in children who have hydrocephalus, or water on the brain. Children with this condition have an abnormal amount of cerebrospinal fluid built up in the cavities inside their brain, compressing the brain tissue and usually leading to blindness, seizures, mental retardation, paralysis, and if it's not treated, to death. However, Lorber described dozens of children and eventually some adults who had severe hydrocephalus but seemed to lead normal lives. In fact, in a sample of children in whom the cerebrospinal fluid filled up 95% of their skull, leaving virtually no space for any brain tissue, half of them had IQs greater than 100. 30 years ago, Lorber published an article in the prestigious journal Science entitled, "Is Your Brain Really Necessary?" The brain scan on the left of this slide is a normal brain. The gray area is the cerebral cortex, the part of the brain that thinks. And the black area in the very center is the cerebrospinal fluid in the central cavity. On the right is the brain of an adult with very severe hydrocephalus. The vast majority of his head is filled with cerebrospinal fluid, with only a very thin ridge of brain tissue pressed against the skull. Hardly enough to allow this person to live, let alone function normally, according to modern medical neuroscience. However, this particular brain scan of the person with hydrocephalus was actually from a graduate student in mathematics at Cambridge University with an IQ of 126. Some of the best evidence of consciousness functioning independently of the brain comes from near-death experiences. Profound experiences that some people report when they have been on the threshold of death. Of course, there was a Tibetan tradition of people called Dalogs who have returned from death to describe what they've experienced. Their experiences are in some ways similar to the near-death experiences that I am talking about. But the typical Dalogs leave their body for many days rather than just a few minutes. And their experiences usually include extensive travel to a realm beyond death. The near-death experiences that I am talking about are very brief accounts of people who have been clinically dead but are then resuscitated or revived spontaneously after a brief interval with memories of what they experienced during that period. They typically report exceptional mental clarity, vivid sensory imagery, a clear memory of the experience, and an experience that is more real than in their everyday life. All of this occurring under conditions of drastically altered brain function, under which the materialistic model would say that consciousness is impossible. These near-death experiences are reported by between 10 and 20% of people who are revived from clinical death. I have investigated almost 1,000 of these cases. The average age at the time of the near-death experience was 31 years, but there was a very wide range. One young girl reported an experience she had had when she was 8 months old and undergoing kidney surgery. The oldest near-death experiencer I have studied was 81 at the time of his heart attack. About one-third of these near-death experiences occur during surgical operations, one-quarter during serious illness, and one-quarter happened during life-threatening accidents. The common features of near-death experiences can be categorized as changes in thinking, changes in emotional state, paranormal features, and otherworldly features. Changes in thinking during the near-death experience include a sense of time being altered. Often people report that time stopped or ceased to exist during the experience. It also includes a sense of revelation or sudden understanding, in which everything in the universe suddenly becomes crystal clear. There is a sense of the person's thoughts going much faster than usual and being much clearer than usual. And finally, there was a life review or panoramic memory in which the person's entire life seems to flash before them.
Okay, that was about does consciousness need a brain? And we'll take up some more of that talk tomorrow night. The show tomorrow will be from 7 to 8. We've changed the time. It used to be from 8 to 9. Now we've changed that time back to 7 to 8. So if you're free, tune in again and we'll take up the doctor's experience and talk in this area. So it's pretty elucidating to hear the evidence that consciousness can exist without the brain. All right, now we're going to go and we'll rest our mind for a few minutes because we're going to go over to Sarah Brightman again. This time she's singing with Cliff Richard, who was a famous singer in the days gone by. He's still a great singer. And it's the name of the song is Only You. I'm just queuing it up here. Just take a minute. Okay. I think we're ready to go.
But I could not. every day disappeared into the distance. Together we'll make the whole world move in sympathy. Only you have the power to move me.
Sarah Brightman and Cliff Richard. Now, Cliff Richard was well known many years ago. He's still a great singer, and hopefully we'll have more of him on this show in the future. But they sing beautifully together, and so now we'll go back to another spiritual teacher, and his name is Spiro. What's his first name? Won't come to me right now, but we've had him on the show before. He's not as common as some of the other teachers, but he's still very good, and he can explain things in a different way than other people. All right, I just delayed getting that, but I think it's coming true now.
Yes.
How do you look for the eye?
Well, okay, let's take a...
It's looking for the eye when you have those really strong emotions come up.
Yes.
How do you...
Okay.
How do you look for the eye?
Okay, let's take
an example. It's about when strong emotions come up.
Somebody says something to you which is hurtful, and you feel upset. What is it that is upset? That someone has said something to you. You've heard some words, and the words are heard by awareness. You're aware of the words. You hear them. Now, so, for instance, if someone was to say something like, oh, what a beautiful afternoon it is, that wouldn't upset you. Okay. 2 minutes later, somebody says something which is hurtful or upsetting. So what's the difference?
My story. Like,
okay.
Usually I would be, they shouldn't have done that.
Okay, so, but what is saying that? Because whatever it is that hears the words, what a beautiful afternoon, those words are heard, yes? There's heard and there's no response. They're just heard. Yeah? Now, then somebody says something which hurts you, and there is a response. I'm upset by that. Now, what is it that is upset? Is whatever it is that heard the words upset? In other words, is awareness, you know what I, you understand what I mean by awareness?
Yes.
Is awareness upset? No, I mean, can awareness is like an empty space, yes? It's, imagine awareness like the space of this room. It's just pure sensitivity. It can't be upset. Why not? It's because it's empty. There's no resistance in it. In order to be upset, something has to rise up and say, no, I don't like what's been said. But in the absence of this something, the words just flow through. Like if someone was to throw a ball through this space, it would just flow through. It wouldn't meet with any resistance. So awareness is like that. It hears the words just pass through. Like the words, what a lovely afternoon it is. It just flows through and it doesn't leave a trace in awareness. It doesn't leave a trace in you, yes? It doesn't scar you, it doesn't hurt you. Now, when you hear the hurtful words, something in you rises up and meets the words. The words are floating through you and something rises up and clashes with the words and says, I don't like that. What I is that? The I that doesn't like these words. It's not the I of awareness, yes? Because awareness is like an empty space. So what I is it? But
I think
it's the I you think you are. Okay, but now go to that I. Try to find that I. What I exactly is that? Where is it? What's it made of? I mean, you're feeling on its behalf. You call it I, so you must know it. Where is it? What is it? What do you find when you go towards it?
Yes, I see it as like that story of, I don't know.
It's a story,
yeah.
Yes. Can a story be upset?
Then it's, I guess the story that something's wrong gets upset.
Yes, and on whose behalf is that story being told? Who is the central character in that story?
Well, me.
Me, you point to your body, but is your body upset by these words? I mean,
it feels upset, so I get tightness in my stomach and tightness in my chest.
Yes, yes, but your body has not been upset by the words. The tightness in your chest or your stomach is the result of being upset. Yeah, it's the echo of the upset in your body, but it's not the body itself. Your cheek or your nose or your ear doesn't get upset when you hear the words. Yes? There may be an effect on your body, but leave the after effect, because we're going to the actual feeling itself. So now go back. Who is the one, the central character of this story, the I that is so hurt and upset? What do you find when you go back, when you go towards yourself?
I don't find like a thing. I just find... I guess that's what I identify as me, that somehow I've been wronged or...
Okay, but what is that I that has been wronged? We've it's not your body, yes? We've already discovered.
Right.
It can't, it's not your body. It's not a thought. You can't wrong a thought, yes? A thought. You can't upset a thought, yeah? So it's not your thought that has been upset. It's not your body that has been upset. And it's not awareness, the one that hears the words, because that's just an open, empty space that is open to everything.
So it's like some sense of myself.
Okay,
some sense
what is that? It's not your mind, it's not your body, and it's not awareness. What is it?
I mean, is that ego? Is that
No, but
I don't know what it is.
No, but you're feeling on its behalf. You don't know what it is, but you spend much of your life thinking
right.
and feeling on its behalf.
What is it?
You tell me, you're the one that is claiming the existence of this one.
I don't know, I can't identify what it is.
Perfect, you're quite right. Why can't you identify it?
It doesn't exist.
It's not there. It's not there.
But it feels like it is.
It's not there. It's a fictional I, an imaginary self, on whose behalf we spend most of our lives thinking, feeling, acting and relating. And yet when we just pause, like we do now, and say, okay, what exactly is this I? Let's be really specific and scientific. What is this I on whose behalf I spend so much time thinking and feeling? It's not my body. Your body is not upset by some words. You can't upset a thought or an image. It's not my mind that is upset, although the mind can express upset. And it's not awareness, because awareness is open and empty. What else is there in your experience? There isn't anything else. It's a fictitious I. It's the ghost in the system that is not really there, on whose behalf we spend most of our lives thinking and feeling. Now, when you discover that, when you go to the I, you're feeling upset, and instead of getting mad with the person that did whatever they did, you say, okay, I'm just going to go towards this I that is upset. Now, when you don't find it, when you can't find the one on whose behalf the upset is taking place, what happens to the upset?
I assume it would just go away, because there's no shoulds anymore. There's no reason to be upset.
Perfect.
Because I don't have to fix it or do anything.
No, of course, you don't have to fix it, because you've seen that the character upon whom the upset feeling depends has been discovered to be non-existent. When that happens, the bottom drops out of the story of the upset. What you will be left with is a wave, because as you rightly said, this feeling of upset has an impact on the body, a feeling in your chest or your belly. That will remain, but it's no longer a feeling of being upset, it's just a sensation. And because that sensation has no functional purpose, by functional purpose, there's a sensation, you're holding the mic, yeah? There's a sensation there. That sensation has a functional purpose. It's there. The sensation, that the residue of upset in the body, has no other purpose other than to support the separate self that was upset. It's a kind of ally in the body of the separate self. Now that this separate upset self has been seen to be non-existent, this sensation in the body no longer has a job, it's redundant, and it will just be gradually dissipate out of the body as a result, because it's not required any longer. And the body will be washed clean of this tension and will be returned to its natural state of openness and sensitivity. And then the next time the feeling comes up, you do the same thing again. You explore the I around whom it revolves, and you go back again and again and again and again, and you experience for yourself over and over again that this I, this separate I on whose behalf you have been thinking and feeling for so long, is not there. When you look for this I, you find the I of awareness, open, empty, at peace. And this gradually becomes your identity. You begin to take your stand as that awareness, not as the reactive, upset self.
And then from that place, you would actually react with wisdom in the
exactly.
situation.
Exactly. You still have reactions, but the reactions are no longer on behalf of a self that is always trying to defend itself or aggrandize itself through reactivity and relationship. There'll still be a response to a situation. You don't become a stone. On the contrary, you become very sensitive. But your reactions, your responses, will be responses, as you say, of wisdom, of love, of understanding.
And you would also recognize that that's where it was from and not from a place of reactivity when you got to that point?
Yes. You would
layers upon layers of
you
that.
Would know in a response. You would feel, if you responded to a situation, you would know there's a kind of... You recognize that your response came from love. You just know. Somehow you recognize it. It's when it's like, if you're a musician, you play the right note. You just know it's right. Somehow, if your response has been a loving response and an intelligent response, even if it was a firm one, something in you knows, I know that came from truth. I know that was a loving response. I wasn't trying to defend myself. I wasn't trying to put the other person down. I wasn't trying to aggrandize myself.
Okay, I thought that was quite an interesting talk because it harmonizes very well with what Buddha said 2,500 years ago. He said that this self that we take to be our real self is non-existence. It's the source of our pain and suffering, and in order to get out of the area of suffering, and he was concerned with man's suffering, that was his main message, it was necessary to find the real self, to identify, as Rupert Spira says, to identify, to find and identify the real self, not with this mental projection that we think is ourself. You know, it's very interesting, from the age of 18 months up to the age of 18 months, when a child looks in the mirror, he doesn't think he's the body he's looking at in the mirror. It starts about 18 months, and it starts with everybody when he first sticks his toe in his mouth and he's able to suck his toe. Everyone's clapping and saying, great, that's wonderful, wonderful. And then when he starts crawling around, everyone's clapping and he gets all the attention, it's wonderful. When he starts to walk, he gets all the attention. And so everyone is, celebrating all his physical achievements with his body. So gradually he begins to identify with the body, and that's the first of many identifications. Other identifications are whichever country you belong to, whether you're a man or a woman, what culture you belong to, etc., etc. So anyway, in this talk, Rupert Spira pointed out that this self that we make up to our memory, to our projections, etc., this is a false self. And when you go looking for it, and a good time to go looking for it is when you're actually suffering, you go in there and you try to find out, Well, who is this one that's suffering? It's like you call somebody to witness stand. Well, you call them forward. You say, "Who are you? Let us identify you." No, you're not the body. Who are you? So, in this case, the lady went in there to see who it was that was causing all this reactionary things that going on in the body and in her environment. And she didn't find a real self. She found, yes, she found feelings. She might have found pain. She might have, she found thoughts. As Spiro says, thoughts of themselves can't react, but and the body can't react, and awareness only perceives in an innocent way. I'm not sure I agree with him on the fact that our projected images might react. If we have a certain projected image and some other occurrence happens that is in conflict with that, maybe that causes some turbulence. I'm not sure about that. But anyway, that's how this is the process of self-inquiry. We look at what our essential nature is and how we function. This is called self-inquiry, or the teachings of non-dual duality, or Vedanta in the East, all coming from way back thousands of years ago from Shankaracharya. Every Indian person knows who Shankaracharya is, the most well-known saint in India. All right, having said all that, I think it's time to move on to some more music for you. And this time we're going to have, again, Sarah Brightman and Andrew Bocelli. These are the two, my two best loved singers in the whole world, these two people.
Forse stiamo insieme solo qualche istante. Se ti stiamo ad ascoltare, il cielo alla finestra, questo mondo che si sveglia nella notte, già così lontana.
Guarda questa terra che gira insieme a noi, anche quando è buio. Guarda questa per noi, a darci un po' di sole, sole, sole.
Ma è l'arte che se l'amore mio, sento la tua voce e ascolto.
That was Andrea Bocelli and Sarah Brightman singing Canto.
Picture the home you always dreamed.
Get it now.
And then realize some things don't require any confidence.
Canto something
because
Terra.
Security is not
so anyway, good singers, great singers. And next now we're going to go back to Master Muji. And in this one... in this one, there's an exercise for you to do during the week, and this is an important. It's important to get the exercises that I play on this program, because that will propel your consciousness forward. Okay, I'm just queuing it up for you here. I should have had it done already, but it's coming up right now.
Almost all the time, this I am is contacting the mind, is going to the mind. And at least you begin to see the influence and the presence also of the habit of associating with the mind. But don't give up. Muji, please speak about meditation, love from Tov, but meditation. Best meditation, simple meditation, anybody can do it, but we're not going to call it meditation. I don't want to use a name because it becomes something else. But the best, if what you're asking, this feeling, the natural feeling of being inside this body, the sense I exist, it is common to all the sentient beings have this feeling, I exist. Not just the words, I exist, the intuition, the feeling of presence, the way in which you know you are alive. Nobody gave it to you. It just is present. It is the voice of the life force and the consciousness. It is saying, I am. This pulsation is inside. Only after this arises, then perception of otherness can come. This is the earliest manifestation of the Absolute, in the dance of multiplicity. This must first be there. The original seed, the seed of existence, the feeling I am or I is synonymous with that, it's identical. You are to know this. When you say I is consciousness, it is the godly principle in the form. It is already there. It is already there. But it reveals itself in the waking state and in the dreaming state when consciousness is available. It manifests itself as I. So I and consciousness, they are one. Know that. Somehow, as soon as consciousness makes itself known to itself as the feeling I am, it gets associated with the body. It starts to identify with the body and start to feel I am the body. But it is not the body. It is only I am. It is only I am. But it says I am the body. And once this I am the body feeling forms, a new identification arises as me, the person, the personal. This is a modification arising out of the pure feeling, the intuition, I am. I just want to say this thing. And it becomes now, even when the feeling is there, I am the body, this I am the body feeling comes out of consciousness. It is supported by consciousness. And this is why the personality feels real. Not because it by itself is real, but because the root of the personality is the consciousness. And it is the consciousness that you love. I was making an example a few days ago. I said, if a being came and said, I am very pleased with you, so much so that I'm offering you the entire world. I give it to you because I love you so much. But one thing, you have to exchange what I have to give you for consciousness. I give you the universe, you give me your consciousness. Would it be of any value for you? No. Because without consciousness, nothing, no perception, nothing can be tasted. Not even the sense of existence will be there for you like this. So the consciousness is that important. And it is already established. You don't have to go somewhere else to find consciousness. That is foolishness. Because the very I that you feel is itself consciousness. But because this consciousness has somehow developed a limitation onto itself by identifying with the body, it starts to look for consciousness. This is how absurd it all becomes. When the identity, I am the body, is functioning, and you don't realize that this arises out of a purer consciousness, unassociated consciousness. So having said this, I leave it there for a moment. I'm going to tell you what I have to tell you now. The sense I am is already there with you, unsupported. It is there. But it has a tendency, a kind of reflex, to identify as the body. And you must watch this. Try to isolate the feeling I am. And don't let it contact any other concept, belief, memory, intention, desire, attachment, images. Keep it by itself. Just a feeling of being. Now, I know how easy that becomes. But maybe sometimes you may feel this is very difficult to do. Because when I try to do this, I realize how attached I am to my mind. Almost all the time, this I am is contacting the mind, is going to the mind. And at least you begin to see the influence and the presence also of the habit of associating with the mind. But don't give up. Feel the sense of existence, natural sense I am. Just here, it is here with you. Inseparable from you. When you say I, this is the real source and being of I. It is consciousness. And it is formless. It is formless. But when it's in the body, it starts to believe I am the body. So don't be aware of this. I am the body feeling. Leave it. Leave it be there. This I am the body feeling is appearing in the consciousness itself. Just feel the natural sense I am. And don't associate it with anything else. In the beginning, some people find a lot of noise come. Like a tsunami of thought come. That is okay. In fact, don't be disturbed by this. Why this comes is because of the very power of trying to isolate the I am. Keep this exercise going. And gradually, you'll begin to feel a sense of separation. Just the feeling of presence and the feeling, the closeness of thoughts will feel like they're drifting away. And the presence will feel more strengthened. Stay with this. And what you will come to see gradually is the feeling I am the body or I am an object or anything else become weak. And only there is a supreme, beautiful presence here, unassociated. And the perfume arising out of this isolation of the intuition of the feeling I am, the perfume coming out is peace, a natural joy, spaciousness, and an intuitive knowing or conviction that I have no beginning and end. You will know this. Don't study this. Don't look at it in a book. You will know it arising out of your own book. Just this you do. Not 3, 4, 5 things. Hold on only to the sense I am. Allow it to marinate in itself. Don't add any more herbs and spices from anywhere else. Let it stay by itself. You can call it meditation, or nothing. Don't call it nothing. Just do this. Don't put any titles around it. Don't try and make it into something special. Just by yourself you do this. If you sit quietly 5-7 minutes, get used to this feeling. Because the beingness, it enjoys to be by itself. For a while it is in association with these other qualities, but these qualities, they are temporary. Then these qualities and the association with them begin to disturb the being. It wants to get rid of them. So this simple exercise of keeping the beingness to itself, this is the most beautiful, most powerful, most potent meditation, you can call this thing. But don't tell anybody it's meditation, just you do it. Soon you're going to love it so much that you will not want to practice anything else. Just do this. This is the first, most potent and simple aspect of self-inquiry. It is an aspect of self-inquiry. And it is the simplest instruction anybody can give you about this. Because it doesn't matter what religion you come from, it doesn't matter what things you believe, even if you're an atheist, you can practice this. And you'll come to find that fullness of being and presence. So sometimes I send people out, okay, go with this now. Don't forget about anything else. Don't practice any mantras, don't do anything else. Just you stay with this, practice this, come back in a few days and share your findings with me. Just this. So I think that will deal with this question for the moment. This is enough for that. Anything else people want to tell you, oh, there's another minute, forget about it. Anything more than this you don't need. Somebody will tell you, oh, there's another kind of meditation on the blue light, forget about it. Because the blue light will be seen by the I Am. The I Am is there first. The blue light is not seeing the I Am. The I Am is seeing the blue light. You will come to know the earliest. Everything else is secondary. Everything else you're perceiving is secondary, momentary. They come and go. They are appearances. And only this, the I Am-ness itself, will lose all the different garments, all the different colors that it's associating with. Like Eric was saying, and now I just want to be, I don't want more clothing now. This is what he's speaking. Don't want more thoughts. I don't want more belief. Don't want more experience. Just want to be naked. Mean I don't want to associate with anything.
You noticed there, one of the things you said was, I don't want more beliefs. It seems to me like most of the religions, or all the religions of the world, is made up of beliefs, thoughts and beliefs. That's where the dogmas come. And that's one of the reasons why, of course, they fight among themselves, because they each have different thoughts and ideas. But in this kind of place here, the I Am-ness, that's an area, it's a feeling area of consciousness. It has stillness or quietness attached to it. And in this area, this is the divine consciousness. So it's very, very important that you focus on the I Am-ness. The beginning of this program tonight started off with the I Am-ness in the ancient, how it was applicable to the words of Jesus of Nazareth, and how it's applicable today, how it's necessary to focus on the feeling of the I Am-ness. It's not something you need to create. It's already within you, every person. You just have to abide in this feeling of I Am-ness. It's more of a feeling. It's more of a feeling than it is of anything else. Okay, good. Now we're going to have some music again here.
Opera da Evita, innumerevoli altri. Ecco, ed è proprio la sua voce. Lei ha una straordinaria.
after all that I've done. You won't believe me. All you will see is a girl you once knew, although she's dressed up to the nines. But sixes and sevens with you, it happened. I had to change. Couldn't stay all my life down at here. Looking out of the window, staying out of the sun. So I chose freedom, running around, trying.
There you have it, the best singer in the world, Sarah Brightman. I used to go to her concert when I lived in London, England. Of course, she was in the original cast with Michael Crawford in Phantom of the Opera, which was wonderful, my favorite opera. Okay, so now we're going to hit some information about meditation. And this comes from Eckhart Tolle, actually his wife, I believe, is speaking on this. And it's about to bring your attention from the outer world of chaos and activity and to bring it into a more subtle level on the way to the silence and the quietness and the stillness within. In order to do that, this is a technique of doing that. It's a technique to bring your attention to your what we call your inner body, the energy that's contained within your physical body. So if you could have a seat somewhere or sit down or be in a quiet area or lie down if you won't fall asleep, and just subtly follow along with the directions that you get in this tape here.
Sit on an upright chair or cross-legged on a cushion on the floor. Close your eyes. Become aware of your breathing. Feel the air moving in and out of the body. Become aware of any physical sensations you may feel, such as tension, tightness, or pain. We may call this the outer layer of sensations. Notice the sensations and continue to feel them. Relax the body, especially the areas where you feel any tension or tightness. If you feel pain, whether it is physical or emotional, notice the sensation. Allow yourself to feel whatever it is you are feeling. As you continue to watch and feel, you may notice the mind wanting to label the sensations as tightness, tension, pain, anger, or whatever the emotion may be. The mind may want to revive a memory or tell a story about the emotion. However, don't be interested in the memories and stories. Just be aware of the feeling. Without the memory and story, it is only sensation. Continue to be aware and feel the breath, an outer layer of sensations. Now see if you can turn your attention even deeper to the sensations of the inner body. If you cannot feel the inner body, start with feeling your hands. Hold your hands in front of you with palms facing up. Make sure the hands are not touching or resting on anything. However, you may wish to rest your elbows on your knees or a pillow. Make sure your eyes are closed. ask yourself, how do I know that I have hands? Feel your attention move into your hands. You might feel a slight tingling, warmth, numbness, or aliveness. This is the beginning of feeling the inner body. Feeling this life force is your connection to stillness. Now let your attention move into different parts of the body. Your arms, your shoulders, now feel your hands, arms, and shoulders together. Now bring your attention down to your feet. Your legs. Your hips. Don't worry if you cannot feel a certain part of the body. Just be aware of whatever parts you can feel. Now feel your torso. Your neck. And head. Now see if you can feel your entire body as a single energy field. This is who you are at a level deeper than the physical. Keep your attention on feeling the entire inner body for 5 minutes or so and enjoy your meditation.
Okay, that was Eckhart Tolle's wife giving you some directions how to meditate, how to go into the quietness. And so hopefully that's of some help to you. I couldn't get the volume up any higher. I hope it was coming out pretty good there at home for you. I don't know if it's the way it's recorded or if there's, I just don't know. Something about the soundboard here, how to get the sound louder than what I wanted. Well, we're coming towards the end of the program now, and so I'm just going to play a very short one here. It's the very shortest one. It's only 4 minutes long. It's by Master Muji again, and let's see how this goes.
One thing I don't understand very much is the oneness, of how we are all connected.
Forget about it. Oneness will be revealed. Don't try to be one. Don't try. How far you will go? You're going to reach a point you're going to want to exclude somebody. If you try to include everything, I love to be one with you. him. There's somebody I saw yesterday. I'd love to be one with that one. Huh? This one, I want to remain being two with this one. Forget about trying to be one with anything. First, come to be completely alone. Go the opposite way. Be completely alone. Don't look for any support from anything for one moment. And no arrogance about it, no pride, no cynicism. But for one moment, see how you are only by yourself. Don't associate with anything at all. Don't follow any invitation or any promise. See, come to this place to be completely alone and see if you're in a crippling position. Come to this place first. Can you be alone without holding on to some promise, some intention, some person, some fantasy, some expectation, something from the past? You can do now. You can do. Doesn't take long.
Yes.
Yes. Remain the unassociated presence. Remain without information. Reject any information about yourself. It came after. It's not original. Yeah?
Yes.
What remain?
The spaciousness, the vastness.
Yes. Are you imagining? Let's be clear. Are you imagining this? Is it a kind of visualization? So vast.
It's more of a feeling.
It's feeling. Is anything excluded from this spaciousness?
I don't see like individual
very great
things.
This is the allness. The minute you begin to itemize 1, 2, 3, the minute you begin to count, you will exclude. Don't count. Reject everything. Come completely to that space which is not belonging to some other space, and nothing is belonging to it. Who follow? Be in that. And see if there is any suffering, any need for desiring something, insecurity, fear, any of this is there with you.
Okay, we've come to the end of another program. I hope you've enjoyed it. I've certainly enjoyed trying to get this information out to you. And again, our next program is tomorrow night between, the time has been changed. The time will be from 7 to 8 tomorrow night. Every week it's on Monday and Tuesday. On Monday from 6 to 8 and Tuesday from 7 to 8. Now that's the new time for Tuesday. And I'll say good night, and we'll look forward to seeing you at the next show or one of the upcoming shows. So we'll go out with a nice song from Sarah Brightman, and this one is called Love Changes Everything, which is very true. And it's coming up now. I'm just queuing it up here, just queuing it up. Always trying to get rid of some ads here that don't belong.
Love changes everything, hands and faces, earth and sky. Love changes everything.